From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, deposed dictators. How do they live now? And do they feel any remorse? We hear from journalist Ricardo Orizio, author of Talk of the Devil, Encounters with Seven Dictators. The seven include Idi Amin of Uganda and Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier of Haiti. Also, we talk about suicide bombers with Joyce Davis, author of the new book Martyrs, Innocence, Vengeance, and Despair in the Middle East. Davis is deputy foreign editor at Knight Ridder Newspapers and is a former Middle East editor at NPR. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The leaders of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Bahrain have joined with the new Palestinian prime minister in renouncing terrorism and pledging support for the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace in the Middle East. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak spoke through a translator after the group met with President Bush today.
President Bush gave impetus to the peace process by his vision of two states, Israel and Palestine, living in peace and security.
And Secretary of State Colin Powell said the meeting with the Arab leaders set the stage for tomorrow's three-way summit between President Bush and the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers.
This is an important moment in Middle East history where we have the parties coming together, aligned behind the president's vision of June 24th of last year. And now with a roadmap that the parties have accepted, which gives us a way to get to that vision.
Tomorrow's summit will take place in Jordan. Suspected serial bomber Eric Rudolph has pleaded innocent to detonating a deadly explosion at a women's clinic in Birmingham in 1998. Rudolph was brought before a federal judge there today. Steve Chiotakis of member station WBHM has the story.
Rudolph appeared for about 15 minutes before federal magistrate T. Michael Putnam at U.S. Court in Birmingham. After pleading not guilty, the judge asked Rudolph if he understood the two-count indictment against him. He said he did. When asked if he understood if he's convicted of one of those charges, he could receive the death penalty, he said he understood. He was then escorted under tight security back to his Jefferson County jail cell. Trial could take months to commence. He's accused in the deadly 1998 bombing at a women's clinic that performs abortions, as well as other bombings in Georgia, including the 1996 Olympic Park blast that killed one person and injured more than 100. He also faces the death penalty in Georgia. After eluding police for 5 years, Rudolph was arrested in North Carolina over the weekend. For NPR News, I'm Steve Chiotakis in Birmingham.
A new study finds that more than a quarter of all Americans age 55 and older struggle with daily activities of living, such as cooking, housework, yard work, and shopping, but don't know where to turn for help. Others are simply lonely and need someone to talk to. The research was conducted by the AARP. To address that need, a national network of community-based organizations called Faith in Action is seeking volunteers. Actress Della Reese of Touched by an Angel fame is the spokesperson for the group.
I am a minister, and in my church, there are people who need this kind of help. We, as people of the church, try to help our own individual people, but I'd like to extend it further than that. I would like for people to know that there is free assistance.
Reese says by providing volunteer help, Faith in Action aims to help senior citizens be able to stay in their homes as long as possible. Wall Street today, the Dow gained 25 points to close at 8,922, and the Nasdaq was up 13 points at 1603. This is NPR News. The Health Minister of Canada says the World Health Organization has decided not to reinstate a recommendation that travelers avoid Toronto, despite the dozens of suspected cases of SARS there. The Toronto area is the only place outside Asia where people have died from the respiratory ailment. Health officials in the city have reported 62 probable cases that have become known after the initial outbreak in the spring was believed to have been under control. Voters in Denver are selecting a new mayor today in a runoff election. They're choosing between a local businessman and a first-time candidate whose unique style has taken the city by storm. And Denver's two-term city auditor is also a candidate. Nancy Greenlease reports.
John Hickenlooper, a brewpub owner, has crafted an image of himself as a political outsider with fresh ideas. He stormed the airwaves with quirky ads in which he walks city streets filling parking meters to keep people from getting tickets. Hickenlooper holds a double-digit lead in polls. He failed to win a majority in the first election. Don Mares, a longtime public official, has campaigned on his government experience, which he says will help the city cope with a projected $50 million budget gap. Often it seemed the two candidates were competing for voters' laughs, running funny ads, and keeping the campaign positive. The winner will replace Wellington Webb, who is leaving office after 12 years because of term limits. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Greenlease in Denver.
Martha Stewart's company has announced she is likely to face federal criminal charges as part of an insider trading scandal. Stewart's firm, Martha Stewart Living Omni Media, says federal prosecutors intend to seek a grand jury indictment against her. Stewart, through her attorney, has denied the allegations. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, working in the fight to stop hunger in America and reminding listeners that June 5th is National Hunger Awareness Day. On the web at helpstophunger.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The nature of evil has long fascinated historians and storytellers, and most of us have wondered at one time or another what it would be like to come face to face with someone capable of inhuman cruelty. Our guest, Italian journalist Riccardo Arizio, has spent years tracking down former dictators, living either in exile or in captivity in their own countries. His new book, Talk of the Devil, is based on his interviews with deposed rulers from seven countries and their relatives. His subjects include Idi Amin of Uganda, Jean-Claude Duvalier of Haiti, and Mira Markovic, the wife of Slobodan Milosevic. The dictator's crimes range from torture to mass execution to, in two cases, cannibalism. Some of them amassed enormous personal wealth at the expense of their poor nations. Others seemed driven by ideology. Riccardo Arizio has lived in Milan, London, and Atlanta and has served as foreign correspondent for CNN and two Italian newspapers. He now lives in Kenya with his wife. Riccardo Arizio recorded this Fresh Air interview with Dave Davies last week while I was away. Dave has guest-hosted Fresh Air and is a senior writer and reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News.
Did you find some of these leaders craving attention, anxious to talk to you, dying to be important again?
No, quite the opposite. Maybe dying to be important, certainly, but certainly not interested in having a conversation with me or with any journalist. They all feel that they have nothing to gain from giving another interview or talking to people who associate their name with evil. They say, whatever I'm going to tell you, you are not going to change your opinion about me, so why should I talk to you? You know, in many cases, the chase, trying to locate these people, trying to have access to these people, have been more difficult and more, in a way, more fascinating and certainly much longer than the actual encounter, the actual conversation with these people.
Idi Amin, you found living in Saudi Arabia in the city of Jeddah, living the life, he says, of a devout Muslim.
Oh, yes. He lives this very secluded life in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. He's the host. He's the guest of the Saudi royal family, and he's someone who has no regrets at all.
But he is probably the most notorious dictator in Africa. Is it true that he actually practiced cannibalism?
Well, he claimed to be a cannibal. He said in a famous interview, said, oh, yes, you remember that minister of foreign affairs that used to sit in my government some time ago? Well, you know, I got him killed, and actually I ate his flesh. And he made the joke, I didn't like him when he was alive. I actually didn't like him when he was dead because his flesh was too salty for me. Now, it's very difficult to understand whether there was a highly ironic statement to make to go along with the cliche that we all have in the West about, cannibalistic African dictators, or whether he's just, plainly mad.
He was known for broadcasting executions on television, right?
Yes, and making sure that the people who were going to be executed were wearing white shirts in order to make the blood more visible to television viewers. He became quite famous when he used to send shiploads of Ugandan bananas to Great Britain, saying, I hear that you have some economic troubles. please feed yourself with these good bananas and remember that, you know, we have a lot of history in common. We used to be your colony. We're still good friends. Now, you know, was it being very satirical? Was it being very ironic towards, you know, the British government? Or, again, it was plainly mad? He used to name one of the streets of Kampala after Adolf Hitler. And he used to send telegrams to Richard Nixon in the White House saying, I hear you have a problem with the Watergate. Just kill your opponents. It's a bit ruthless, you know, but it works quite well. It's a very efficient way to deal with internal opposition.
The advice was to have them all killed?
Yeah.
Yeah. When you finally reached him, I mean, of all the people, he probably had the reputation for being the most sadistic. Did it seem that you were in the presence of a man who was frightening, unhinged?
Yes, he's an extremely friendly man, quite jovial in his mannerism. At the same time, he acts and looks like someone who could kill you just for no reason.
What gave you that feeling about him?
Well, for instance, he looked at me and said, you know, I'm still on top of things. I'm still a good friend with a lot of important people. Do you believe me? Of course. You have to believe me because this is what I'm telling you. And I said, yes, of course, Mr. President. But I'm sure that maybe not on that occasion, but on similar situations 20 years before, he could have killed somebody who was saying, oh, no, no, this is not like you say. You know, he doesn't have any moral value and he's totally detached from reality. Besides, he's killed 300,000 people at least. And cause so much suffering that, you know, what makes it, you know, another victim doesn't make much difference.
And he's still interested in African affairs and apparently trying to intervene. Didn't he ask you to try and get a package to northern Uganda?
Yes, he tried to send containers full of sensitive equipment to northern Uganda, southern Sudan, where his eldest son is staging a war against the Ugandan forces, possibly on behalf of the Sudanese Islamic government. So he's still somehow involved. And, you know, if you try to analyze the reasons why the Saudi royal family is giving him safe harbor, they must have a political reason for doing that, apart from the reason, the official reason, which is Islamic solidarity that is due to a former head of state. So somehow Idi Amin is still involved in African politics and especially in that terrible war that is destroying that part of Africa where eastern Congo, northern Uganda, southern Sudan meet.
We're speaking with Ricardo Arezio. He is the author of a new book, Talk of the Devil, in which he interviews seven tyrants, in some cases the relative of these former dictators from other parts of the world. Ricardo Arezio, Jean Bedel Bokassa of the Central African Republic, is not as well known as some of the other leaders that you interviewed, but among the more bizarre, he considered himself above other heads of state because he crowned himself emperor in 1977. What was that coronation like?
Oh, yes, it was one of the most bizarre episodes of recent African history. He spent one-third of the national budget on that farcical coronation ceremony. He had thousands of bottles of French champagne imported to Central Africa. He had a golden carriage pulled by white horses. He spent an enormous amount of money in having a crown crafted by Parisian jewelers that reminded of the Napoleonic crown. Actually, he believed to be a Napoleon, and the event was staged in the Bokassa Stadium on Bokassa Avenue near Bokassa University. And he invited all the most powerful men on earth. And none of them actually accepted the invitation. Only minor figures attended the coronation ceremony. But in a way, when I interviewed him, when I said why you did that, he said, well, first of all, I was not paying that money because France gave me the money to afford the ceremony. So if they paid, why should I have refused? And second, he said, only because I'm African, you believe I cannot be a little bit grandiose about myself? Why African head of state could not, you know, should not have the same paraphernalia that Western heads of state had. I said, but Western heads of state do not proclaim themselves emperors. They said, my father was a king, and therefore I was entitled to have a proper crown and to sit on a throne that was of imperial proportions.
Bokassa spent a lot of time enriching himself in this poor country, but he was also known for a lot of brutality. Right?
Yes, of course. The French paratroopers who eventually deposed him found corpses, human corpses, in the fridges of the imperial palaces. And
in the refrigerators?
Yes.
Next to the kitchens?
Yes, yes. Now, whether that necessarily means that he was also a cannibal, as it is claimed by several sources, this is not sure. I asked him the question. He said, no, of course, I've never been a cannibal. How can you think that a French army officer, as I was before becoming the president and then the emperor of Central Africa, could also be a cannibal? I fought for the French against the Nazi Germans during the Second World War. I was trained in Western military academies. In a way, he was trying to say, I'm a civilized person. How can you believe that I was a cannibal? But on the other hand, it is well known that the elders of the African tribe where he came from were and still are cannibals. So the story is not entirely far from reality.
Did he have any explanation for keeping cadavers on ice at the kitchen where one of his residents is aware?
No, he didn't have any explanation. He just said, these are all inventions. This is no reality. The French tried to damage my reputation, inventing all these stories. But they only had a political agenda to pursue. I was not useful anymore to the French government, and so they tried to destroy me and to depose me.
Unlike other leaders who you interviewed in exile, when you interviewed Bokassa in 1994, he was living in the country that he exploited.
Right? Yes, he had been sentenced to life. Then the sentence had been commuted and a shorter one. But yes, he was a free man. But I must say he was a free man with no financial means. And he was a very sad Sikh old man. But, the idea that you can put a head of state or a former head of state in front of a tribunal and putting on trial is a very recent idea. It's a very young idea that is still not accepted by everybody, as we know. And, in those days, it was totally inconceivable that a former leader, world leader, as he was, as he had been, could face that kind of justice.
We're listening to an interview that Dave Davies recorded with Ricardo Orizio, author of Talk of the Devil, Encounters with Seven Dictators. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview that Dave Davies recorded with Italian journalist Ricardo Orizio, author of Talk of the Devil, about his encounter with seven deposed dictators.
You found the former dictator of Haiti, Jean-Claude Duvalier, in France. He was, of course, the son of his father, known as Papa Doc, François Duvalier. He appears to be a tyrant who took to his role somewhat reluctantly. He says he was only 19. He wasn't so sure he wanted to do it.
Yes, he actually said, I want to go to university. I don't really want to become a political leader. I don't want to be involved in the family business, which was ruling in a ruthless way Haiti. But he told me this amazing story. He was 19. He was called to his father's office. All the father's assistants and counselors were around him. And Papa Doc told him, son, you don't know, but I'm going to die soon because I'm seriously ill, and the revolution duvalieriste, our revolution has to go on. And being you the only man in the family, you have to take on the job. He said, but I'm too young. father said, remember the books that I gave you to read about Roman emperors or about De Gaulle, about important historical figures? You should have read the books, and now you should be ready to take on the job as president of life. And Baby Doc said, well, but the Constitution says that you cannot be head of state until the age of 30. And father said, oh, don't worry about that. We'll change the Constitution tomorrow. In fact, next day, the Constitution was changed. The age was brought down to 20, but Papa Doc died when Baby Doc was still 19, but nobody noticed, of course. A few days later, Baby Doc Duvalier became president for life of Haiti.
One of the things that is most known about this period of Haiti was the brutality of the Tonton Macoute, the secret police. And when Jean-Claude Duvalier ascended, as you said, to the leadership of the country, really as a teenager, I wonder to what extent he was aware of their brutality and to what extent he ever thought of striking a different course. Could he even be his own man?
No, he could not. You know why? Because the father, even when he was dead, he was still the most powerful man in the country and the most powerful person within the Duvalier family. Papa Doc Duvalier is still a god in the voodoo firmament. And actually, Baby Doc Duvalier never felt to have the freedom to change the situation because there was somebody above him, his father, still looking down and making sure that things were run, you know, according to the family rules. He takes voodoo religion very, very seriously. And he says, you know, you Westerners criticize us for this voodoo rituals and voodoo customs, but this is our religion. We don't criticize you for your religion. Why should you criticize us for our religion? That's part of our culture. That's part of our heritage. And the Tonton Macoute, let's remember, were not only henchmen. They were also agents of the voodoo sects within the African black population of Haiti. The population was subjugated not only to the ideology of Duvalierism, was subjugated by the religion. Religion had been an instrument. And you ask me, was Baby Doc aware? Of course he was. He's still hoping to become a semi-god in the voodoo firmament once he's dead. It's part of his life and hopes for the future.
Did you speak to people in the New York City, for example, who hoped to bring him back to power?
Absolutely.
What were your impressions of
that? There are regular meetings, and they worship the good old days of Duvalier, because they say at least in those days there were jobs, there was no hunger, there were roads. And go to Haiti today and look what happened in the meanwhile with your democracy, with your freedom, with your empty slogans that you try to impose. We didn't need that. We had our own regime based on our traditional values, and yes, maybe it was a bit tough on the opposition, but you know, it was a price worth paying in order to have all the other things that in the meanwhile have disappeared.
The Duvaliers were known for enriching themselves, owning major enterprises which got cash breaks from the government, and yet Jean-Claude lives a relatively austere life now. Where did all his money go?
The first wife managed to secure a very important settlement during the divorce case. Besides, Duvalier loved to spend the money he had. So he lived a few very flamboyant years after his exile, after being deposed. And then the rest of the money was taken by the wife. So he lived through some difficult years. The current wife, who is not wealthy at all, she used to pay the electricity bills for him, the water bills, the restaurants for him. He didn't have a single penny. So I asked him, how do you live now? And he says, you know, some friends help me. Possibly the friends who still hope in a future Duvalier regime. Because a lot of people in Haiti, a lot of people who now live in Europe and in the States, made huge financial profits out of the Duvalier family. It's not only Duvalier and his immediate family that profited from that.
We're speaking with author Ricardo Orizio. He has written a new book, Talk of the Devil. You spoke with Mira Markovic. She's the wife of Slobodan Milosevic. You spoke to her while her husband was in The Hague on trial for war crimes. Interesting, in the interview, there was a moment when she actually phoned him and didn't ask you to leave the room. What did you observe of their interaction?
Well, they were chatting like teenagers and giggling like teenagers. And at the end of the conversation, she said, "Oh, Slobodan is such a beautiful man. I really adore him." No political statement. She didn't say, "Oh, he's so intelligent," or "Oh, he's so a great politician, a great leader, great statesman." She said, "Oh, he's so beautiful." And, you know, I know that she made several similar remarks in other conversations, and you wonder of the sanity of somebody who can encapsulate the biography of Slobodan Milosevic saying he's a beautiful man. What about the ethnic cleansing? What about the suffering? What about the disaster of 10 years of wars in the former Yugoslavia?
Well, you asked her and other leaders involved in the ethnic cleansing about that. What did they tell you?
Well, she told me two different things. The first one is that it is not true, that these are fantasies, these are propaganda. The second is that maybe some excesses were committed on the ground, but it was not the leadership's fault. It was not because somebody in Belgrade had decided so, but because some little obscure fanatical men on the ground had gone a little bit too far, maybe. But she said, "This is not my fault. Go and ask them why they did it."
It's the opposite of "I was following orders." People were not following orders.
Yeah, but then I went and talked to the little obscure men on the ground, including a couple of people who are now sitting in The Hague, awaiting justice, just like Mr. Milosevic. And they said, "But we were little men. We were not aware of this political plans. We had been brainwashed. We had been told that it was a matter of life or death, and that we had to defend the Serbian people against its many, many enemies." And yes, we were a little bit, we were brainwashed by Mira Markovic and her husband. It is their fault. They should have known better.
Dave Davies speaking with Ricardo Orizio, author of Talk of the Devil, Encounters with Seven Dictators. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Easter Island, a novel about two women living 60 years apart by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, suicide bombers. We talk with journalist Joyce Davis, author of the new book Martyrs, and we continue our conversation about deposed dictators with journalist Ricardo Orizio. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview that Dave Davies recorded with Ricardo Orizio, author of Talk of the Devil, based on his interviews with seven deposed dictators about their lives after losing power.
Few Americans know much about Albania, which was ruled for nearly a half century by Enver Hoxha and his wife Nesminje Hoxha. Enver Hoxha died in the 1980s. You found his wife now living in a prison cell in the capital of Tirana. When you went in, you went with a female host who actually found it, was afraid to look at her. What was that all about?
Yes, she was afraid to look at her. She was even afraid to pronounce Mrs. Hoxha's name, because that name was inspiration of terror and horror for many generations of Albanians. She was afraid to look at this woman in the eyes, maybe because she had been brainwashed that this super powerful couple, Mr. and Mrs. Hoxha, Uncle Enver, as he was called, and the wife, had incredible supernatural powers. You know, we have to remember that the streets of Tirana, the capital city of Albania, the streets of Albania were full of slogans saying, "Thank you, Uncle Enver, for the incredible progress and wealth of Albania. Thank you for giving us this fantastic life. Thank you, Uncle Enver." And Albania was, still is, one of the poorest countries in the world, was one of the most isolated countries in the world. It was a big, huge bunker. And actually, to show how isolated the country was, she and her husband had built 700,000 small bunkers with holes to keep guns pointed towards, you know, some enemies that, according to them, were ready to invade Albania. And you know why the enemies wanted to invade Albania, according to the ideologists of the Albanian regime? Because Albania was the last remaining bastion of pure socialism. They had dismantled their relationship with the Soviet Union in the 60s because they said, you know, after Stalin, Soviet Union has betrayed real socialism. Then they became allied of the Chinese. But then in the late 70s, early 80s, China's went soft. They said, betrayed again the ideology. So, you know, they said, we are like the stalwarts of the purity of the ideology.
The Hoxhas also carried Marxist orthodoxy to real extremes, for example, in persecution of religion.
Absolutely. They destroyed every single church and mosque in the country, and they were the first country that proclaimed itself and the official religion being atheism. And again, when I made this point to Mrs. Hoxha, who was in a prison cell, I said, but how is it possible? I mean, it's not civilized to destroy every single place of cult in the country. She said, there might have been excesses committed in this area. I agree. But let's not forget that religion can also be very poisonous and very dangerous. See what's happening now in the Balkans. See what's happening in many countries where religion is taken as an excuse for terrorism, for fundamentalist opinions. So she said, you know, in a way, we were living in a day where there was a division in the world between East and West. We belonged to the East, or rather we were even better than the Eastern Bloc. And in those days, it was important to state that religion doesn't differentiate between citizens of the same country. Albania has Christian Orthodox, has Catholics, has Muslims. And under ours, there were no troubles between the three different communities. And nowadays, there are troubles.
She seems to be a contrast to some of the dictators you interviewed in that the couple did not seem to enrich themselves at their country's expense the way some other rulers did. What were they motivated by?
I think they were motivated by a very sick form of idealism, if you want. They were motivated by their experience as partisans in the civil war against the Nazi Germans and against the fascists during the Second World War. They, in a way, believed that Albania should not change from the Albania of 1946, after the Italian occupation, after the German Nazi occupation, this new Albania opening to the world. They believed that in 1986, Albania should be the same as it was 40 years earlier. So they were not motivated by financial ambitions. There were rumors of the Hoxha family having, you know, bank accounts in Switzerland, owning property in several countries, Italy, South Africa. And that was not true. I'm not saying this in their excuse. I'm not saying that this justifies the crimes committed by them. But I'm saying that, yes, their case was a very evident case of somebody who did what they did, pursuing an extremist political agenda and not necessarily personal agenda, even if it's interesting to remember that Mr. and Mrs. Hoxha and their sons were the only people in Albania allowed to own a drive a private car for 40 years. No one else in Albania had or was allowed to have a car.
Ricardo Arizio, it's remarkable that you spent years tracking down these dictators and their relatives, all of them accused by human rights organizations of a whole list of atrocities. And in the 200 pages of interviews, nobody admits to doing anything wrong. They're all victims of circumstance, prisoners of a difficult historical juncture, slandered by their enemies. Were you surprised that no one accepted responsibility?
Yes, I was, because I was hoping to find people who are getting older, who really have to face maybe the last years of their life, people who have to reconcile themselves with themselves. And I was hoping to find somebody ready to maybe cry in front of me and say, yes, I was horribly wrong. I was horribly wrong, and I want to ask forgiveness for that. It didn't happen. They all went into the minutiae of the little things that justified this act or that other act. They didn't see, in a way, the bigger picture, which was the bigger picture of the horrible suffering caused by their actions. And it is, in a way, very discomforting to see how little we remember about these people. These people were the men and the women behind the killing fields. These are recent historical events, and still we are all too ready to forget or maybe even to forgive them.
It is one of the most striking things, I think, about the book, because I think when we look at the world's most brutal leaders, we expect to be fascinated. We expect to see people who are monsters, perhaps tormented by some psychological damage, but they seem ordinary, uninteresting people.
Yes, but some psychopaths are really ordinary people, look like or behave like ordinary people. And this is, I think, has to be a warning. I mean, when a democracy, when a society is in danger, it is not necessarily because a very remarkable person is trying to take over. It might be somebody who initially looks like a normal politician, might be somebody who initially looks like a normal general. But eventually this person and also the historical circumstances, cause a tragic situation. We should be very vigilant in a way and see and recognize the early symptoms of a dictatorship.
Did you, when you talked to these people, find any of them that you think might have succeeded in a Western democracy, who had leadership skills that might have worked in a different context?
Well, certainly Milosevic is someone who had certain skills that could have been applied to a Western democracy. He is a man I'm sure many Western leaders thought that you can do business with. It is not a coincidence that he was welcomed and invited to the United States when he was negotiating and then signing the Dayton peace agreement for the Balkans. In fact, his wife says, you know, so if my husband is such a monster, why nobody said he was a monster while he was at Dayton putting an end to the wars in the Balkans and signing the Dayton agreement? You know, in a way, it was a moment of statesmanship for him.
Did you find anything in common in the family histories of these dictators, particularly in their relationships with their parents? Anything strike you?
Yes. In a way, they were all looking for a father figure. They were all looking for somebody bigger, more important. They were all looking to be adopted. Mengistu wanted to be adopted by Leonid Brezhnev, the Soviet leader of the time, and he called them my father. Bokassa wanted to be adopted by General de Gaulle, the French president. And Idi Amin, of course, wanted to be accepted at Buckingham Palace as a peer. And Jaruzelski was infatuated with Mikhail Gorbachev and with the previous Soviet leaders. And it's very interesting to see how many of them actually lacked a real father. They didn't have a father, or they lost their father very early in their life, or they had a very difficult relationship with their father. In a way, they were all looking for a new big daddy, as Idi Amin used to call himself.
I wonder if any of the former dictators you spoke to were troubled by the experience of the former Chilean dictator, Augusto Pinochet, who strayed from his country, found himself arrested and held accountable for his crimes.
Quite the opposite. The few ones who mentioned Pinochet did so, saying, Pinochet is still wealthy, still respected by some sections of the Chilean society. He's still free after that episode in Britain. And, in a way, yes, of course, many people think that Pinochet was a terrible dictator, but he's not labeled a monster. So why you want me to bear the label of a monster? And, in a way, yes, they used the story of Pinochet as another explanation of why we're using double standards towards them.
Ricardo Arizio, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Ricardo Arizio is the author of Talk of the Devil, Encounters with Seven Dictators. He spoke with Dave Davies. Dave has guest-hosted Fresh Air and is a senior writer and reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News. Their interview was recorded last week while I was away. Coming up, Islam's teachings on martyrs. This is Fresh Air. Islam's teachings on suicide and terrorism is the subject of the new book Martyrs, Innocence, Vengeance, and Despair in the Middle East. My guest is the author, Joyce M. Davis. She's deputy foreign editor at Knight Ridder Newspapers and is a former Middle East editor at NPR. Her book is based on her travels through the Middle East, interviewing the families of suicide bombers, men who train the bombers, and Islamic scholars. How would you describe the difference between the Christian and the Islamic concept of martyr?
Well, Christians generally see martyrdom as a passive act, as one in which a person is willing to die. But the ideal martyrs have not been those who also kill. Now, that's not to say that's not known in Christian history, because I can think of Joan of Arc as an example right away of a warrior martyr. But by and large, the Christian martyr is a pacifist, someone who allows himself to be persecuted and killed. Islam, on the other hand, has a more aggressive creed with regard to how the faithful are to respond to what they see as evil in the world. Islam does not have a creed such as Christianity that calls for turning the other cheek or doing good to those who are evil or do evil to you. Islam, on the other hand, believes that the faithful have a duty to fight evil, and they must use all means to do that.
Do you think suicide bombings fit the classic Islamic definition of martyr?
Frankly, no. I mean, in the research that I have done, which has included extensive interviews with some of the leading Islamic scholars, the basis of Islam clearly says that any suicide is forbidden. So right off the bat, you're looking at the foundation being weak in support of suicide bombings. If indeed the religion says no suicide, then how can a suicide bomber fit into the realm of Islam? That being said, you do have Islamic scholars, or at least some of the militants, who argue that in some cases, suicide bombers may be justified. And why do they say this? They say this because, first of all, when I talked to Sheikh Yassin of Hamas, the spiritual leader of this militant group in the West Bank, he says that it all depends on the intention. If the intention of the person was not really to commit suicide, but to fight or defend his land, his religion, his people, then indeed it's not suicide. It's an act of war.
Are martyrs supposed to abide by Islam's teachings on just war, and do they fit in with those teachings?
Islam sets very strict standards, very strict rules for war, for just war. Several of those rules are completely outside of the bounds of what many of the suicide bombers, and particularly those who attacked the United States on September 11th, have done. One, Islam forbids attacking innocents, especially women, children, the elderly, the weak, the sick. This is very, very clear. So you would have to look at the actions of suicide bombers who indiscriminately walk into, let's say, a pizzeria, one of the cases I profiled in the book, and realizing that as he walked in, he was walking past baby carriages. You would have to say that he was not given any thought to what Islam's real teachings are on it. Now, on the other side of that argument, you have people who would argue that, but yes, those suicide bombers who attack military targets, who attack government installations, are indeed fitting into the concept of just war in Islam. And for example, with September 11th, I could hear them arguing, if they took the time to do so, that we're going to strike at military installations, the Pentagon, for example. We're going to strike at the foundation of U.S. power and wealth, the Twin Towers. So in their arguments, they probably try to make a case for their actions as being part of just war. But most of the scholars that I've spoken to say that those actions, September 11th, and those that attack innocents, have no basis in the religion.
How much of a debate is there among Islamic scholars in the Gulf region and in the Middle East about whether, you know, suicide bombings and September 11th are justified under Islamic law?
There's a great debate. There's a raging debate going on within Islam on these issues. But overwhelmingly, the Islamic scholars, the mainstream, including many of the militants, I have to be frank with you, including many of the militants, just thought it was an outrage, September 11th. And actually, I did some stories for Knight Ridder to that effect. Frequently, many of the American media, unfortunately, didn't take the time to cover that. And Americans don't know the great outrage amongst the scholars, Islamic scholars, that came after September 11th. But the debate rages. Just what is justified? Is suicide? I mean, in particular, the debate rages with regard to suicide bombers in Israel. That's where the issue is. What happened to the United States? It's generally conceded outside of the bounds, but the debate on whether Palestinians have a right under Islam to use suicide bombers against Israelis, that's another matter.
What's the difference between what happened in the United States on September 11th and what's happening in Israel with Palestinian suicide bombers in terms of the Islamic debate?
Yes, well, when I've talked to scholars about this, two different issues. One, they say that the action of September 11th occurred outside of what they call the Islamic land. So these people left their own land to attack people outside. And again, the attack seemed to many people to be indiscriminate, to include innocents, including many, many Muslims, as we well know, were killed in those attacks. So that's number one. With the Palestinian-Israeli situation, as they see it, the Palestinians and Muslims in general are fighting to reclaim what they consider to be holy land. Remember, Jerusalem is also holy not only to Christians and to Jews, but to Muslims as well. So they see that as a demand that they must fight to recapture that land. They also see the Palestinians as a people under siege, as a people who are fighting for their own survival. So in this case, the argument is that they are allowed to use extraordinary means, all means, to defend themselves. Still, though, you have many scholars arguing that to attack women and children, even Israeli women and children who may be occupying, as they see it, your land, that is completely outside of the bounds of what the religion dictates.
My guest is Joyce Davis, author of the new book Martyrs. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joyce Davis, author of the new book Martyrs. It's about suicide bombers and the Islamic debate over whether their actions can be justified. The book also looks at how children are used as soldiers. You went to the Martyrs Museum in Iran. What's the purpose of the museum? And maybe you could just describe it for us.
It's a very interesting building. When you walk in, of course, there's a deep red carpet that runs the length of this long hall. And that red carpet, of course, symbolizes the blood of the martyrs. So you walk in and there's this somber music that's playing as you walk in. Off to each side of this long hall are different rooms and with cases, glass cases, in which the Qurans of different martyrs or their personal effects or what they were wearing on their last days are showcased. The center of this museum, of course, are the martyrs who died in the Iran-Iraq War. One of the ones that I profile in this book is a young boy named Hossein Famada, who was, at the age of about 13, was killed when he threw himself under an advancing Iraqi tank and blew it up with himself underneath it. Now, this young boy has just been lauded throughout the country and by, you know, all of the Ayatollahs as a prime example of the nobility of martyrdom. And martyrdom in amongst the Shia in Iran is especially revered because of the history, the foundation of Islam, in which the prophet's son and grandson were brutally killed, as they see it, in defense of the faith. So this museum is almost, it's a very eerie feeling. But it's also it's somber and it's moving in many ways, as you see that people like this boy deliberately gave their lives for their causes.
The exhibits at this Martyrs Museum are, some of them are divided by age. And yes. Like one wall, I guess it is, that's devoted to martyrs is categorized ages 10 and under.
Yes, yes.
That's and really young.
Yes. Well, it is. It is. But you have to understand these are also not people who deliberately, in some cases, the definition is not someone who was fighting on a battlefield, but who may have been killed within a battle. Right. So these are also young children who were killed as well.
Now you say that Egypt and Israel have the most experience battling Islamic militants and martyrs. What do you think we can learn from their experiences, from what they've done right or what they've done wrong?
Well, one of the things we can clearly learn is that it's impossible to stop it without extraordinary brutality on our part. Why do I say this? I look at the Egyptian model. Egypt fought the militants for you know, several years, for a decade, during the 80s and early 90s. And they used extraordinary means to do so. They are criticized, the government has been criticized for violations of human rights, for basically going into homes and not caring who was there in search of the militants. It was able, we thought at one point, to crush the movements, the two movements that were working there. Al-Ghamal al-Islamiyya was one, and al-Jihad. But what we later found was that they really didn't crush those movements. They sent those people off into exile. People like Ayman Zawahiri fled Egypt and ended up circumnavigating the globe to end up with in Afghanistan with bin Laden. So Egypt basically sent its militants out to wreak even more havoc in the greater world. Israel also has a daily battle with militants. And what we have seen is that the most stringent efforts to cordon off the West Bank, to infiltrate the groups, to bomb the West Bank cities, none of that has been able to stop the suicide bombers from getting through to terrorize. And yes, it is terrorizing, to terrorize Israelis. This is an issue that cannot be battled by military or defensive means alone. It must be done as part of a complex package of solutions, which has to involve a look at what is fueling this kind of rage.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Joyce Davis is the author of Martyrs, Innocence, Vengeance, and Despair in the Middle East. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the Internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Wiley, publishers of The Iron Triangle, Inside the Secret World of the Carlyle Group, Dan Briety's investigation into the intersection of big business, government, and defense, available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Youssef Ibrahim. He's researching a book on oil and war. Also, Elaine Pagels, a professor of religion at Princeton University, discusses her new book, Beyond Belief, about the secret gospel of Thomas, which was suppressed by the church and kept out of the canon. Join us for the next Fresh Air.